From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today is World AIDS Day. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with a doctor who works in the most hard-hit part of the world, Southern Africa. Dr. Hussein Kuvadia is the head of pediatrics at a South African hospital. He says that the legacy of apartheid is affecting the medical treatment his patients receive. Kuvadia is also the chair of the next International AIDS Conference, which will be held in South Africa in the year 2000. Also today, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human by literary scholar Harold Bloom. And pop music critic Ken Tucker reviews Is This Desire, the latest release by the English singer-songwriter and guitarist Polly Jean Harvey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Chad Pergram. Exxon and Mobil have announced a $77 billion merger. The combined oil and gas companies will surpass General Motors to become the world's largest corporation. From member station WNYC in New York, Kari Pitkin reports.
The richest merger in history is expected to reshape the global oil industry during a time when oil prices are at a 12-year low. By merging, Exxon and Mobil expect to save $2.8 billion. Although the companies have not announced any job cuts, industry experts estimate as many as 20,000 layoffs. Last year, Mobil and Exxon combined gasoline sales represented 20% of the U.S. market, which may concern the Federal Trade Commission. Analysts say federal regulators will try to reduce the company's concentration of gas stations in the Northeast. In addition, the companies may have to sell stations and refineries on the West Coast and in the Southwest. Wall Street analysts predict it could take as many as 9 months for the companies to close the deal. For NPR News, I'm Kari Pitkin in New York.
On Capitol Hill, the House Judiciary Committee is again hearing impeachment testimony. Today, members are listening to two women who were punished for lying about sex in a civil suit. Legal experts and military officials are also testifying about perjury. The Judiciary Committee plans to vote on articles of impeachment against the president next week. Such articles would then go to the full House for debate and vote. Three filmmakers stranded in the Arctic have been rescued. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
A Russian helicopter swooped down through a blizzard to rescue a three-man TV crew early today, taking them from the remote Wrangel Island to the northeastern Russian port town of Pivik. The three men, a Russian, Japanese, and Australian, rushed to the nearest restaurant to have their first healthy meal in weeks. The three had been working on a documentary film about polar bears. They said they were ready to leave in mid-October when suddenly the weather changed. They were stranded in a small wooden home with dwindling food supplies and only some heat provided by diesel fuel. But it was not entirely desperate. They did have a satellite phone and access to the internet. The Russian wildlife expert who was part of the team says they also managed to shoot many extra rolls of film. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
Secretary of State Madeleine Albright opened an international conference today on the status of art and assets looted by the Nazis during the Holocaust. Albright said that the goal of the conference must be justice and how to gain restitution of the stolen property and money. The conference is being sponsored by the State Department and the Holocaust Museum in Washington. Representatives from more than 40 countries are attending. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 34 points at 9081 in heavy trading of 359 million shares. The Nasdaq is up 4 points at 1954. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a federal judge in Chicago has thrown out a lawsuit brought against several major U.S. drug makers that suggested a conspiracy to fix drug prices. Defendants in the case included big companies such as Johnson & Johnson and Forest Laboratories. The class action lawsuit alleged that people were denied price discounts over a 7-year period. Another down session on U.S. financial markets, at least so far today. At one point, the Dow was off more than 100 points, though blue-chip stocks are off their earlier lows. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Day two of the latest Wall Street downturn, and once again, fears that dominated the stock market earlier this year seem to have returned to some extent. While many market analysts say those fears were overblown, the same argument could be made for the market's recent run-ups at a time the overall global economy remains fairly weak. There were mixed signals in the two latest reports on the economy out today. The National Association of Purchasing Management says its index for November declined as companies placed fewer orders. The dip in the index, the sixth straight, was viewed as the latest sign the economy is slowing. At the same time, though, a private research group said its index of future economic activity suggests some possible improvement. The Conference Board says its index of leading economic indicators rose 0.1%. The LEI is designed to predict how the economy will perform 6 to 9 months down the road. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Another corporate Japanese firm has fallen victim to Asia's financial downturn. Medium-sized JDC Corporation, a construction company, has sought bankruptcy protection from creditors. JDC has debts of $3.3 billion. It's Japan's second biggest failure in the construction industry. An official with the Japanese Economic Planning Agency says that other failures are expected in the future. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day. Here in the U.S., new drugs have helped many people with AIDS to continue on with their lives. But these drugs are too expensive for the most hard-hit part of the world, Southern Africa. The statistics there are horrifying. In several African countries, nearly 1 in 4 adults has AIDS. This year in sub-Saharan Africa, 2 million people died of AIDS. Over half of the people who were infected there this year live in South Africa. My guest, Dr. Hussein Kuvadia, treats South African children with AIDS. He's the head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School. He's also the chair of the next International AIDS Conference, which will be held in South Africa in the year 2000. 40% of the children in Dr. Kuvadia's hospital have HIV. Almost all of them got it from their mothers during labor or through breastfeeding. I asked Dr. Kuvadia to describe his hospital.
It's an old apartheid structure, which meant it was meant for Africans mostly and people who are not white. Nowadays, it's nearly always Africans who attend, so therefore it is not a well-endowed hospital, but it's one of the largest hospitals on the continent. It used to be more than 1,500 beds, so it's a huge hospital. It's a so-called teaching hospital, so-called. It's meant to be a hospital which trains doctors and nurses and postgraduates. So that's why we call it a teaching hospital. But apartheid ensured that the resources went to hospitals which were often treating white patients. So many hospitals in Johannesburg, Cape Town, Bloemfontein, etc., which were previously for the exclusive use of whites, were much better endowed. This is a dreadful place, but we do our best.
What kind of treatment can you give the babies and the children who have AIDS?
I think we give them what is available to children who are not HIV infected. That's in a nutshell, that's what transpires, I guess, in most developing countries. In most of the African countries I've been to, it's similar to what happens here. That is, the diseases they have are common diseases. They have diarrhea, which is common in HIV uninfected children. They have pneumonias, which are common in uninfected children, and so on and so forth. So they simply slot in to the routine treatment of children, and that's what we do for them. I think that there's much more we can do, but at the moment, the resources haven't been provided, certainly to us, to guarantee or to promote the additional treatment that children with HIV require.
If you had more money and more resources, what would you be able to do for the children?
Oh, I think we'd make their lives infinitely better. There are things that we could do that are being done in the U.S., for example. And when I see the results of that, the lives of children in the U.S. are far, far better catered for than the children we see over here. For example, the use of antiretroviral drugs in children is proven to have multiple benefits. It's not just the attack on the HIV virus, which it does efficiently, which these drugs do efficiently. So you reduce the load of the virus in the baby, and therefore you make the baby better. But the child recovers from other diseases more rapidly. The child grows better. The child feels better. And so these innumerable benefits accumulate just from antiretroviral therapy, which is not available to us. It's not available to nearly all the countries in Africa that I've been to. So that's simply at the level of the provision of antiretrovirals. But there are other things we could do. There could be better care in the homes, which is cost-efficient, which means it's often affordable in developing countries. Care for children at home, more follow-up by some type of health worker. Doesn't have to be a health professional, a health worker in their homes to make their lives a bit easier, to cater for the repeated infections, for the failure to grow, the 1,001 other problems they have. So that sort of community outreach program is simply not available, even in South Africa, which is not as poor as most of the countries in Africa. It's a relatively resource-rich country. It's a middle-income country, if you wish, more on the scale of places like Brazil and Thailand and so on. So we don't have that outreach program either. We don't have the sort of clinic support, by which I mean a dedicated group of doctors, a specifically identified group of nurses, social workers, occupational therapists. You name the whole range of problems, because these kids have almost every organ involved. You need a wide range of disciplines to cater for them. If I had that, if I had a unit which looked after these children, I could provide much, much better care. But we simply don't have it. And I can understand the government's difficulties when it has to decide on priorities. Do you decide on priorities which deviate or divert funds from children who are uninfected towards children who are infected? It's a difficult decision to make.
Is there a split in South Africa between the haves and have-nots and the kind of health care that they receive if they have AIDS? And, you know, is there a split between the typical, say, white middle-class person's access to AIDS drugs and the typical black person's access to AIDS drugs now?
No question about it. The problems of apartheid are going to take a long, long time. And one of those effects of apartheid which persist to today are the access to resources. There's no question that the privileged, who are mostly, but I must insist that it's not entirely, mostly white, still continue to today, and it's going to continue for a long time. And that's a reality across the board. So whether it's access to justice or education or housing or income or whatever, those disparities still persist, and they will persist for a long time, and it therefore manifests itself in inequalities to access to healthcare for AIDS too. However, there is a difference that HIV/AIDS is not a major problem in the white population, nor in fact, we have a large number of people of Indian origin here too. It's not a major problem in those populations. It's really an overwhelming problem in black African, South Africans, if that's the right term, but that's the group. So the children who are affected are nearly all African children. And they, as I've indicated, get very little in terms of care.
What do you think in South Africa HIV has particularly struck the black population and the white population much less so?
I think it's a effect of the way the disease spreads. So if you wish, in medical terms, it's the epidemiological pattern of the disease. It's the social basis of the disease, and probably it's the economic basis of the disease. But I don't believe, and I don't think many people who deal with the disease believe, that it's simply a question of poverty. It's not that. It's not that. AIDS makes the life of poor people infinitely worse. It makes it much worse. So it flourishes amongst the poor. And the poor people have less access to health care, so they suffer more and they get more of the problems of HIV/AIDS. They have less access to health resources, so they don't get treatment. They may have less education, so they don't have the incentives to use preventive measures. So poverty exacerbates AIDS. However, AIDS doesn't depend on poverty alone, because well-off people also get HIV/AIDS. And if you look at Africa, the example is starkly clear. One of the better-off countries in Africa is Botswana, compared to much of the rest of Africa. The rest of Africa is far worse economically. And yet the prevalence of HIV/AIDS is highest in Botswana compared to most of the other countries in Africa, which are far poorer. And that applies also within countries. So it's not simply a question of poverty.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Hussein Kouvaria, and he's the chairman of the next World AIDS Conference in the year 2000, and he's the head of pediatrics and child health at the University of Natal Medical School in Durban, South Africa. How have you seen the number of AIDS victims grow in the years that you've been at this hospital in Durban?
Exponentially. When it started, the epidemic in South Africa was first amongst white men who had sex with men. So it was a smaller epidemic. And around the late 80s, must have been about 1988-89, we began to see the first cases of HIV-infected children. So that was obviously the first expression of the AIDS epidemic in the heterosexual population, which is the major form of the disease in this country. And we've seen a rise which is absolutely striking. I mean, it is so steep, from virtually zero in, let's say, 1988. No cases, no experience. I didn't even know what a case looked like of HIV. I didn't know what a child with HIV/AIDS might look like. From 88 till now, where roughly about 40% of our wards are filled with patients who've got HIV/AIDS. And it's not just pediatrics. It also applies to the adults. We've been following up pregnant women in our hospital and have seen a similar startling increase of HIV amongst pregnant women. And those pregnant women are also almost exclusively African. That's black African. And from a percentage, you must have been under 1% in about 88, 89, about 27 to 30% of pregnant women in our antenatal clinics are now HIV infected. That's a phenomenal number. It almost translates to about 1 in 3 pregnant women who come to our hospital have got HIV. So it's sweeping through our wards. As it's sweeping through the wards in Zimbabwe, in Zambia, in Malawi, in Kenya, in Uganda, and virtually any other country in Africa which has got a high prevalence of HIV in the adult population.
My guest is Dr. Hussein Kouvaria, head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Hussein Kouvaria, head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa and chair of the next International AIDS Conference. What have you had to do at the hospital to prevent the spread of AIDS within the hospital?
I don't think the disease really spreads within the hospital. I don't think that happens. I think the hospital is really the source of provision of care. And as I've indicated, that care, I think, is inadequate because of lack of funds. But you may well ask, what are we doing about the reduction of the load or the burden of the disease? And that's where we've been trying our best to get to an answer which is appropriate not only for our country, but for Southern Africa and hopefully for the continent and maybe even relevant to all developing countries. So we've obviously been very impressed with the superb results of the American and French studies, which can prevent HIV in children by treating the mother with an antiretroviral, AZT. So that experience really was, it was a signal event. And it meant that we had to now look at the possibilities, because for the first time we now had the possibility of preventing AIDS, almost better than a vaccine, because if you prevent it in a baby, you prevent it altogether. And we are, I guess, on the brink of determining the right sort of policies which apply to our country. So ever since that trial in the States and in France, which is known as ACTG-076, many groups throughout the world, including ours, working independently, working with UNAIDS, working with CDC, working with numerous agencies, have been addressing the question of what's the best regimen of antiretrovirals to produce a similar effect in developing countries. Similar effect because we don't think ACTG-076 can easily be applied for a number of reasons to Africa and other developing countries. So we really have to find our own appropriate intervention, antiretroviral intervention.
Why don't you think it would work in South Africa?
There's been a long debate about that. And to cut a long story short, there are a number of reasons. One set of reasons is logistical, that is, the way the study was designed in the U.S. and France. It depended on having good antenatal clinic services. It depended on having early attendance at antenatal clinic. It depended on having facilities at these clinics for giving intravenous injections. So there were these logistic reasons which made it impossible to translate that into poor countries, especially developing countries in Africa. The second reason is that the population had different risk factors. For example, in the States and in France, you could discontinue breastfeeding and therefore remove a major source of transmission without causing too much of harm to the babies. Now, you can't do that in Africa or Asia or some other poor countries. Breast milk is a really important food. It's a nutrient. In fact, it's the only nutrient which may be available to thousands and thousands of women in Africa. They either cannot afford to buy another type of milk, like a formula, or they may be unwilling to change, because breast milk is not just an ordinary contact of between mother and child. It's deeper. It's got huge cultural connotations, and it's been there traditionally for ages. And as I said earlier, some women just won't have a choice. I mean, formula feeding is not cheap. It costs a lot of money. And people in Malawi and parts of South Africa and Zambia and Uganda simply would not be able to afford that. So it was important to look at the role of breastfeeding and how we can address it. And I must say, we haven't succeeded yet. We have a rough idea what we might be able to do. And we might be able to recommend avoidance of breastfeeding under special conditions. UNAIDS and WHO and UNICEF have made certain recommendations. We can do that. But at the moment, we don't have the perfect plan for reducing mother-to-infant transmission. As I said, 076 has these logistic problems. There has the problems of breastfeeding. There are other biological factors. The factors that cause transmission between mother to infant might vary between developing and developed countries. And lastly, the cost of ACTG-076 is simply unaffordable in large parts of Africa. So for those reasons, that regimen was inapplicable to developing countries. There are a number of other alternatives. The UNAIDS study I spoke about is using not only AZT, but another drug called 3TC. And those results will be out soon, and so on and so forth. So I think in the space of about a year or two, developing countries, governments in developing countries, and protagonists of the, for the reduction of mother-to-infant transmission will have a set of options before them, and they will have no excuse, to my mind, no excuse whatsoever for not choosing one of those options.
So the drug that you're talking about is a form of AZT?
It is AZT, yes. But it is AZT sometimes combined with another drug, and that's called 3TC. Those results are still not available, but will be available soon.
I imagine that many of the people who you see at the hospital are very poor, and that probably a good deal of them are uneducated. Would that be a fair assumption?
You're quite right. As I said before, the effects of apartheid persist today, and the public hospitals where people like me work are really hospitals which are frequented by the really poor, people who don't have medical insurance or don't have their own incomes to pay for private medicine. So inevitably, it is African children, and it is really the poorest of the African children. You know, in a phrase, it's really the poorest of the poor. So they have very, very little resources.
What kind of problems do you have trying to explain what AIDS is to the parents of the children who you treat, or to the children themselves if they're old enough to explain it to?
If you imagine that about 30% of women have got HIV, and that this has been around now for about 8, 9, 10 years, most African people know about HIV/AIDS. They understand it, and many of them have a fair idea of how it's transmitted. So that is not the problem. I think they understand it, and in fact, it strikes fear in their hearts. The problem is, how do you get over the other difficulties of them revealing this information and so on? I think the knowledge is not the problem.
What do you mean by revealing the information?
Well, they know how it's probably spread. They know the dangers of HIV. But it is not a socially acceptable disease in many, many instances. So it is not a neutral matter for a woman to go home and say to her husband, lover, or family that I have got HIV/AIDS. It creates a whole lot of problems with them at home. And there are instances where women are prejudiced, they're discriminated, they're abused, they're expelled, their affairs come to an end, marriages break, and so on. So they have to take that into consideration, and it ultimately depends on the individual woman. If she thinks she belongs in a family environment where she can share these secrets, it's not an obvious thing that she can. So we have to be very careful about advising her what to do about revealing her information.
Dr. Hussein Kuvadia is head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa and chair of the next International AIDS Conference. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, looking ahead to the next World AIDS Conference in the year 2000, we continue our conversation with Dr. Hussein Kuvadia. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews literary scholar Harold Bloom's new book on Shakespeare, and Ken Tucker reviews the new release by British singer Polly Jean Harvey.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this World AIDS Day, our guest is Dr. Hussein Kouvadia. He's the chair of the next International AIDS Conference, which will be held in the year 2000 in South Africa. He's also the head of pediatrics at the University of Natal in South Africa. His country has been very hard hit by the epidemic. About 40% of the children in his hospital have AIDS. Almost all of them got it from their mothers during labor or through breastfeeding. Now, how are most of the women who have AIDS in South Africa getting the disease?
They're getting it from men. Simple as that. Women, the studies that have been done here have shown that women are mostly monogamous, mostly. And therefore, they have only a minority of women, a small, small minority of women would have AIDS, HIV infection because of promiscuity. They get it from men because for many reasons, men have more sexual contact, and that sexual contact leads to the to infection with this virus. Their sexual contact is often with commercial sex workers. It may be with other women who have casual sex, and therefore they are infected, the men are infected, and they come and come back home sometimes and infect the women. So it's in a way, it's the vulnerability of women which exposes them to the risk of HIV in South Africa and indeed in all of Africa. So it's the ultimate form of oppression of black women.
So if I'm hearing you right, that it's often a husband infects a wife, and then if the wife gets sick, she's expelled from the house for being sick, even though she got sick by contacting it through her husband.
Well, I'm not sure if it's such a straightforward linear relationship. What I'm saying is that's the usual way they get infected.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually from the men. The men have got, and we can discuss that a little later, but they are infected under their own circumstances. They pass it on to women. But generally speaking, because women depend on men for their livelihood, they are generally less educated, they have less opportunities for getting jobs, they therefore have less income. There are a whole lot of cultural pressures to keep them in their families, so they are entirely, often entirely dependent on men. And therefore revealing an HIV status is quite a momentous business for a woman in that position. And when she's infected because she can't deny sex to a man who has such control and power over her. She can't insist on fidelity, in fact. She can't insist on knowing if he is exposing himself to other women who might be infected. She often doesn't have that power.
Well, how widespread is condom use in South Africa in the population that you treat, which is mostly poor people?
I can't give you accurate estimates because it's not. We don't have that sort of data. But as far as the government is concerned, there is a national AIDS program, like there are national AIDS programs in much of Africa. And they have distributed millions of condoms, and they are available free of charge. It's not to say they're easily accessible to men, but they are available. I don't have figures, but generally, the anecdotal accounts one has, which means the few odd small studies that have been done, suggest that condom use is not widespread.
I read that the South African government bought about 1.5 million female condoms. Do you know what the result of that was?
They did. They had some difficulties at the beginning because there were some problems about the usefulness of those. But they've just they started using them, and they've been testing their acceptability by women, and I understand they are acceptable by women, but I don't think there are any sufficiently rigorous impact studies to give you any information whether they are effective or not. But I think, you know, they're likely to be effective, but we need to wait a while to see how good they are.
Now, I know you've recently toured several other African countries. Just a few weeks ago, you toured Zambia, which is one of the countries most hard hit by the AIDS epidemic. Could you share with us some of what you saw there?
I think to look at the impact of AIDS in outside of the hospital gives you a good idea of the devastation it's causing in communities. And I think that's what Zambia taught me, at least. I was there for a different purpose, but what it showed when I looked around at the figures that Southern Africa is at the real epicenter of this epidemic globally. And about 70% of all the HIV cases in the world, there are about 30 million, 70% of them are in Africa, and most of them are in Southern Africa. So here we sit at the very raging vortex of this epidemic. And you see it in the figures which indicate the regression in the development of human beings that we had been achieving in the past, say, 20, 30 years. So you see it in the fact that people live shorter lives, and not just 1 or 2 years, but on average, because of HIV/AIDS in the more severely hit countries like Zambia, by 16 years. So whereas they might have lived to, say, 66, they now would live at, sorry, they die at about 50. And Zambia, which I visited, has more people dying in that age group than who are dying of older age, that is, older than 50. It's a pattern which has virtually never happened in the history of infectious diseases amongst humans.
I recently read that although many people have been concerned about rising population rates in African countries, that because of the AIDS epidemic in Zimbabwe, the population is expected to start declining in about 4 years because the country has been so hard hit by AIDS. And that's a really almost shocking reversal in population trends.
I think so. That's true for some countries in Southern Africa. It hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you must remember that the people who we are seeing infected now were infected, let's say, 10 years ago, that's 1988. And the figures then in 1988 were nowhere like they were now. So if you imagine that roughly 1 in 4 adults in Southern Africa, 1 in 4 adults walking the streets, going to work, going to school, playing, etc., 1 in 4 is infected now, can you imagine the horror of the death rates, etc., in the next 10 years? When they will start dying. In a phrase, really, the worst is still yet to come.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Hussein Kouvadia, and he's the chairman of the next World AIDS Conference scheduled to be held in the summer of the year 2000. He's also the head of pediatrics and child health at the University of Natal Medical School in Durban, South Africa, where he says that about 40% of the children that he treats have AIDS. We'll take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. With Dr. Hussein Kouvadia. He's chairman of the next World AIDS Conference in the year 2000 and head of pediatrics and child health at the University of Natal Medical School in Durban, South Africa. Dr. Kouvadia, you're the chairman of the next World AIDS Conference, which will be held in the summer of the year 2000. What are some of the issues you would like to see addressed at that conference? And I believe it's going to be held in South Africa.
It's going to be held in Durban, actually.
Oh, okay.
And the reason we're rather pleased that it's coming here is that up to now, it's never been held in a developing country. And as I've indicated to you before, 70% of the problem is in developing countries. Sorry, in Africa. About 90% of the problem is in developing countries. So here we have a disease where 9 out of 10 cases are in amongst the poor nations of the world, and the conference is held in the rich countries of the world. It's a paradox which is obvious and which needed to be addressed. So that's why we applied. And we thought at least South Africa had, I think, the infrastructure and the facilities to hold the conference. That was important. And secondly, to hopefully refocus some of the priorities of the conference and to bring to the fore issues which are really important to poor black women in Africa, to women in Asia, and hope even women in China and Latin America, to talk about the difficulties of cultural constraints, about community responses, about family support, about the lack of availability of basic resources, the inability to get drugs, and so on and so forth, to refocus the issues for the people who matter most with this particular disease.
What are some of the other cultural issues that you'd like to raise at the conference?
There's another huge issue which affects the transmission of HIV in Africa, and that is the migration of people through international borders. Remember I said that men get infected. Why do men get infected in Africa and not in Europe and so on? It's because of the social dislocation of these migrations. UNAIDS, for example, in a draft document, has calculated, I think, that there's something like 38 million migrants, forced migrants, as people who didn't really want to leave and have left. So that's a huge population, and South Africa is par excellence an example of the devastating effects of such forced migrations on people. You remember our colonial history was such that men from neighboring countries came to work on our mines, and those mines still exist. And most of the men live in single-sex hostels. You can then imagine the destruction of family life, the casual sex, the casual attitudes to sex, the role of commercial sex workers to satisfy the sexual needs of these men who work in mines. That's going on every day, and that's exacerbating or maybe fundamental to the problem of the spread of HIV/AIDS amongst black men in Southern Africa. So that's an issue which we really need to discuss. It's a problem which is not easily resolved because it goes to the heart of economic infrastructure of many of our societies, but I think it must be addressed.
What is your best hope for reversing the AIDS epidemic in Africa?
At the end, I think a vaccine which works in African populations, which is not too costly, which is cheap, which can be delivered appropriately to people on the African continent. I guess that is going to be our salvation, if you wish, for people who are not infected. That is some years down the line, but in a way, when I look at the use of condoms, the treatment of sexually transmitted diseases, and so on, they do have an impact, and we, of course, must continue. But if you really want to make a major impact, I think a proper vaccine is going to be the answer. For children, of course, as you know, we can achieve wonders with antiretrovirals when they are properly and appropriately given.
How optimistic are you that we'll have a vaccine in a few years?
No, I'm not. I don't think it'll come in a few years. I have a sense it'll come, but it won't come under a decade. I don't think so. So we'll have to live with this problem. I don't think the rates of increase of HIV will continue. It's not sustainable that way. I think the at-risk populations get saturated, and therefore the epidemic may level off. You'll get many more people dying, so the number of people with HIV, AIDS, will not necessarily increase at the rate it has been for the past 10 years. So I think we are in for a rough time for the next 10 years or so. But hopefully we won't make the mistakes repeat the mistakes of the past in creating vaccines which become unavailable or inappropriate or don't work in populations in Africa and Asia and Latin America.
This is World AIDS Day, and one of the founders of World AIDS Day, Jonathan Mann, died a few months ago in a plane crash going to an AIDS-related conference in Geneva. I'm wondering how his death affected you and your work.
I didn't know him personally, but I knew about his work, and I think the things he stood for really mattered to me. I think he stood for the public health, the humane issues related to AIDS, and I think he devoted his life to that. I heard him speak on a number of occasions, and he reflects the sort of views that you've heard me expressing here, not just the biological management of the problem, but the social, economic, humanitarian, cultural management of the problem. He had a vision of it, the control of HIV/AIDS, which is rather rare amongst people in the world at his standing, and he was an extremely valuable individual in the fight against AIDS. I think we miss him because of that.
Well, Dr. Kuvadia, I wish you good luck with the planning of the World AIDS Conference in the year 2000, and thank you very much for spending some of this World AIDS Day with us and telling us about your work in South Africa.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Hussein Kuvadia is the head of pediatrics at the University of Natal Medical School in South Africa and chair of the next International AIDS Conference, which will be held in the year 2000. Literary scholar Harold Bloom says that almost daily for the past 12 years, he's read and taught Shakespeare's plays, and he's come to realize that the accurate stance toward them is one of awe. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that's also her stance toward Bloom's latest book called Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human.
Some detractors say that, like Hamlet, Harold Bloom is long-winded, indulging in gassy digressions that bloat his book. Others sneer that, like Lear, without the fool to watch over him, he's grown old and cranky, railing against feminists and deconstructionists who refuse to stand naked beside him on the heath, stripped of theory and footnotes. Some serpent-tongued wits have even compared Bloom to his idol, William Shakespeare, hastening to hiss that, like the bard, he cares too much about making a buck and thus writes too quickly. There may be some truth in all these charges, but set against Harold Bloom's colossal critical achievement in Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, they have as much chance of carrying the day as peas blossom, cobweb, moth, and mustard seed would in a game of tug-of-war with Falstaff. And in fact, Falstaff, whom the outsized Bloom adores and physically resembles, is his most fitting Shakespearean counterpart. Impassioned, opinionated, and wise, Bloom, like Falstaff, is a living rebuke to academic cant and cynicism. Bloom here marshals a lifetime's worth of experience as a reader, scholar, teacher, and playgoer to brilliantly work through all 35 of Shakespeare's plays. As its bold title implies, however, Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, is no simple sentimental journey. Bloom wants not merely to praise the bard, but to arrive at some profound new appreciation of how Shakespeare created human consciousness. As Bloom declares towards the end of his mammoth book, "I do not know whether God created Shakespeare, but I know that Shakespeare created us to an altogether startling degree." Clearly, this is one of those big think theses that can't be proven. Bloom's claims for Shakespeare are destined to stand or fall on the strength of his own language and interpretations. Bloom's writing here is radiant, alive with conviction, intelligence, gusto, and righteous contempt. In particular, his comments on the many awful productions of Shakespeare he suffered through, like Ralph Fiennes' recent travesty of a Hamlet, have the acidic sting of a Sheridan Whiteside theater review. As befits a patriarch of literary criticism, Bloom proclaims most of his insights as truths, handed down from the mountaintop of his erudition. This is a style that even Moses couldn't sustain for very long, but Bloom's pronouncements are so provocative, they grant him the license to spout. Here, for instance, is one of Bloom's many written-in-stone remarks, this one on Macbeth. Macbeth himself can be termed the unluckiest of all Shakespearean protagonists, precisely because he is the most imaginative. With surpassing irony, Shakespeare presents the Macbeths as the happiest married couple in all his work. Is Bloom right? Who knows? Doubtless some of his assertions are just so much sound and fury. Other Bloomian tenets, however, will change the way many of us think about plays whose meaning had become fixed in our minds. Nowhere is Bloom's power as a reader more in evidence than in his discussions of Falstaff and Hamlet, who, Bloom avows, manifest the most comprehensive consciousnesses in all of literature. Bloom worships Falstaff without qualification, but he offers a startlingly revisionary criticism of Hamlet. The Pale Prince, Bloom says, loves no one, not his father, nor Horatio, nor Ophelia, nor even the generations of audiences who've been transfixed by him in what Bloom calls the world's oddest love affair. In the course of moving through the plays, Bloom chants the traditional Shakespearean cries of transcendence and universalism in a largely successful, if temporary, maneuver to drown out the ideological-minded critics he so abhors. Bloom growls, "Marxists, multiculturalists, feminists, nouveau historicists, the usual suspects, know their causes, but not Shakespeare's plays." Leaving aside the vexed question of whether his denunciations are fair or not, it seems to me that what Bloom rightly dislikes about the younger generations of critics is their cool reserve, their guarded unwillingness to give themselves over to Shakespeare. How refreshing it is, in contrast, to hear a credentialed, critical genius like Harold Bloom admit to his romantic feelings for Rosalind in As You Like It. Shakespeare, the invention of the human, may help bring bardolatry back in fashion. It should certainly make bloomolaters of many of its readers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, by Harold Bloom. This is Fresh Air. PJ Harvey is the name for a loose coalition of musicians led by the English singer, songwriter, and guitarist Polly Jean Harvey. Her work has been extravagantly praised for its intensity and its refusal to adhere to any one genre of pop music. Now in her late 20s, Harvey has just released her fifth album called Is This Desire? Rock critic Ken Tucker tries to answer the question.
Did you see her walking? Did she come around here, sir? Black hair, brown eyes, my beautiful warrior. She was also leaving, said I have no one. Even as I held her, she went out looking for someone. Looking for someone.
Polly Jean Harvey is the daughter of hippie-leaning parents from Dorsetshire, a mother who's a sculptor who also produced local blues concerts, and a father who's a quarryman. One of the first things Polly Jean did after becoming a pop music sensation in England was to take opera lessons. This clearly is a woman who knows how to go her own way. And more than any current rock performer of either sex, she knows how to get the maximum effects out of extremes of sound. She's tremendously skilled at establishing a mood and building on it, as she does here on The Wind.
Catherine liked high places. High up. High up on the hills. A place for making noises. Like whales. Noises like the whales.
Many of Harvey's songs on Is This Desire are sung in the characters of different women, or are songs addressed to women in different tones: comradeship, jealousy, sympathy, rage. She plays around with gender roles. A previous album had a gleefully aggressive song called Man Size. In all this, she's more comparable to a contemporary short story writer like Mary Gateskill than to your average rock star. I think a gritty realist like Gateskill would really appreciate the opening image in a song like Catherine, in which Harvey says, "I gave you my heart, you left it there stinking."
Catherine to Barra, you've murdered my thinking. Gave you my heart, you left the thing stinking. I'd shake from your spell if it weren't for my drinking. The wind bites more bitter with each light of morning.
Different reviews I've read of Is This Desire have referred to Harvey as the Emily Bronte of rock, which I don't think quite gets it. True, there's a large element of the gothic romantic in her work, but there's little of the fragility or hopelessness that underpins Bronte's well-written melodramas, and I don't mean melodrama as an insult here. As for an answer to the questions she asks in her album's title, well, in the title song, she wonders whether her love contains enough desire, enough, as she says, to lift us higher, which I take to mean to a higher plane of feeling and consciousness. At her best, Harvey demands that you and I answer in the affirmative. This really is the sound of desire.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publisher of Pete Hamill's tribute to Old Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.